My name is Eric.
Hi, Eric.
I'd like to welcome everyone back. And we're going to have a moment of silence, our best friend in prayer, and then we're going to open the meeting up and get into talking about the history. We have a moment of silence. We're going to have a little something.
Exceptional reading skills. What I'm going to be reading is a letter inventory history that was written and sent on by somebody who couldn't be here today. And hope you bear with me because I'm not the best reader, but I'm the one that got asked to do it, and I've learned never to say no. I sometimes think, especially today, about the reasons why addicts are the way they are, the way they treat each other, and the way they feel toward each other, even clean. When I first came into the fellowship, I experienced a lot of alienation, especially from the dope fiends. It was as though they didn't really understand who I was or where I'd been, and it seemed that if one didn't shoot heroin, go to jail, shoot heroin, go to jail, ad infinitum, one just didn't belong. There just didn't seem to be any room for anyone else. I'm beginning to understand why they thought the way that they did, as I begin to understand myself. Whenever you go to a meeting that is comprised of a lot of different people, you get a lot of different ways of thinking and expressing thoughts. That's why this fellowship has grown the way that it has. We are getting people in who, because of the nature of the drugs, are recovering from their addiction much faster. If the very essence of narcotics was to be explored, they are vastly different than other drugs, and the organization that bears that name, in all reality, probably should have dedicated itself to the cause of narcotics addiction as opposed to drug addiction. I can see today that the addict of long ago wouldn't have joined the organization that you see today. But enough of them were here when the transition from narcotics addiction to addiction occurred that there are enough to sustain a dialogue with the narcotic addict that comes in today. Okay, enough of the lesson. Aside from the fact that the program literature, when created, did state narcotics and sedation, I guess when Jimmy wrote it, that seemed to suffice in its implication. At any rate, the purpose of this paper is to explore the addict in the recovery setting and try to discover what is going on around Narcotics Anonymous. It is difficult because if you are an addict, it doesn't necessarily mean you understand addicts. I can only try to reconstruct things from what I have been able to gather from information I have been given and what I see transpiring today. Not being clean in 1953, I have to reconstruct with some of the information that the founder gave me. I have to say, as acting, sometime biographer, sometimes first person, I will try to tie it together as best I can with the information that I have. In the final analysis, you will have to be your own judge. I am all good conscience, and with the guidance of my higher power, I will do my best to write the truth and hope that it will be received that way. I am motivated to write this because it is, to me, an inventory of sorts, and I hope to be free of the information and make certain decisions for myself based on this. So in part, this is my personal experience that I am sharing with you. Narcotics Anonymous was the idea of a man by the name of James P. Kinnon. I can use the full name now because he is no longer with us. He passed away July 9, 1985. And they started in homes in the San Fernando Valley. That's California. These first meetings were called rabbit meetings because they were held in homes and jumped around a lot. Whoever had the meeting at their house next usually took the coffee pot and a box of green glass cups and saucers. This N.A. is not to be confused with the N.A. that had attempted to make a start a few years earlier in New York City, as reported in the Salvation Army News article, and as informed by a Jesuit priest speaker at the 13th World Convention of N.A. held in New York. There is a tape circulating around the fellowship with this story entitled Junkie Priest. If ever an organization would want to dedicate itself to any individuals, it should be those few suffering addicts who tried and failed in New York because of no support, only hope. It boggles the mind that in a spiritual organization people can fight, take sides, discredit each other, and honestly think that what they do is infallible, even to the point of destroying another's good reputations and good standing in the community, N.A. When we have more than just hope, what we have is reality. At any rate, what happened was the original members got together and met at what was then called the Rhodes Moore Park meeting. Almost from the beginning, there were problems, one being that Sime Elias, who was one of the first AAs to support N.A., was discovered soliciting money from the L.A. County General Hospital, and the hospital was ready to pay it for 12-step calls. Jimmy found out about this and put a stop to it, informing the hospital that we do not charge, we give this away for free. Obviously, those in this very small organization at that time had their own opinions. In the final summation, Jimmy proved right. At approximately the same time, another segment of addicts in the name of Narcotics Anonymous offered our services in Northern California for the purpose of personal gain in the field of drug rehabilitation. I believe it was in Berkeley. Jimmy K. once again met with the people at the university and told them that we don't sell this thing, we give it away. This put the damper on those members' activities and stopped them from, as Jimmy put it, cutting a big fat pig in the ass. These two single activities, along with some differences in basic philosophy in the organization, caused what I shall call the North-South Rift. The basic elements in philosophy were that a couple of members wanted to maintain the steps as the AA version and saw no reason to expand the literature. AA's book and 12 and 12 would be enough. For many years, addicts coming into the program were told to just add the word drugs to wherever the word alcohol appeared and keep on stepping. When Jimmy first wrote and compiled the stories for the first Little White Book, prior to that, we only had a little yellow book, which was informationally lacking. There were still those who were opposing him for even doing that. AA's literature was good enough. I guess if you only knew that it would be good enough, I think at this point we have to remember that the fellowship and information they had was not being related to by the addict at large. This organization was not being started for those addicts who meet to me, who were making it in AA, but for those who were not. At any rate, through dissension and discord, disharmony ensued and almost threatened to destroy any hope of NA ever developing the proper spirit to continue on. All the while, Jimmy continued to have faith in his visions. He never gave up on the addict like so many others had done to us. When the fellowship was waning and waning, you could always find it in Jimmy's maple kitchen table. What he learned about recovery and relapse, he learned firsthand. When in a moment of jubilation, he wrote, "We do recover," he also experienced that. Although it was tough getting started in the early years, consider he was only clean and sober 3 years, he always had faith in his vision, and his vision never failed him. As Jack Whaley was to recall on tape years later, he would go down to Moore Park and see Jimmy Kay and a few loaded junkies, and he would go down there to carry his message. Jack died 18 years clean and sober, was a trustee for many years, and died playing handball of a heart attack. Jimmy's vision came to him at a time when his life again became meaningless. When he began to question his own purpose for being, as he was to relate years later, "A voice told me what I was to do." He never disclosed to anyone what that voice said. but those of us who were close to him never doubted it for a minute. His energy for service in this program was kind of energy that could only come to one who was so inspired. Most of the text part of the pamphlet was written right down at the end of that table, quote, as he was to recount to us in a meeting at Moore Park in which he was taking his 30-year cake. I can only guess at the feelings that must have come to him as he blew out his candles. He always opened his pitch with, "My name is Jimmy and I'm an addict. I'm here because of so many that came before me and can't be here." I don't think that he ever thought that it was he that doeth the work. Even in relating about writing the pamphlet, he merely said that much that was written, quote, down at the end of that table. He never claimed any credit for himself. He was a humble man, but at the same time, with a strong, healthy pride and sense of being, he was a Scotsman. Those of us that were fortunate enough to know him got to know an enduring love and sense of compassion never experienced before. His dedication to NA was unfaltering, and his love for this program unending. Even in the course of my own service, there have been times out of disappointment, disillusionment, and imagined betrayal that I just walked away. Jimmy never did. He held to the beacon light, always helping others to the goal. In the course of my service for many years in the WSO, both as a helper stuffing envelopes and eventual vice president of the corporation, it was he who first asked me to be of service. It was he who first asked me to get involved. I have to say that in all honesty, left to my own devices, I would have called sobriety a new car, and he taught me what we were about, service. The more recovery you get, the more you had better be ready to give it away, because if you don't, you won't keep it anyway. As the disease would have it, NA went through more transitions with some of the members leaving with resentments. The overview would have it that personalities tried to win out over principles. That group split off trying to take the Moore Park meeting with it, and some of the members eventually moved back to Northern California to start the NA that they understood. Amazingly enough, there are still people who claim that NA started in Northern California. And I was 3 years clean myself. I heard a woman at the Santa Rosa Convention in Northern California stand up in front of the fellowship, raise her arms, and tell them that she founded Narcotics Anonymous. Jimmy was present at that function and never spoke to anyone about it. I guess he figured it wasn't worth going into. After all, that was a person, along with a few others, who had almost destroyed NA's chances of ever getting started. If she now wanted to take credit for the whole deal, it was fine with him. All that I really know is that from inception to this very day, we are still dealing with persons, attitudes, and opinions from this original group that couldn't accept Narcotics Anonymous coming into being in its own way without AA literature or guidance. Many years later, as the regional chairperson, I was confronted many times with this issue, particularly in different areas of Southern California that were determined to keep the big book of AA in their meetings and read from it. They made no small thing of this. People came to the regional meetings and raged at me for demanding that they remove those books from the meetings. I put it to the vote, and this region backed me in my stand. I always wondered, after I had been to one of those meetings and saw each member with a book or books, how they in their deepest imagination could have considered themselves an NA meeting. At any rate, I informed them that in order to be considered a part of this region, the books would have to go, or they should just call themselves an AA meeting. Oddly enough, most of those individuals from that area are the same people that are now on the other side of the coin and projecting this new fanaticism that we are experiencing in NA. I guess if you're a fanatic, any cause will do. Jimmy used to say that being a fanatic was part of spiritual growth, and that as soon as you really knew what you were being a fanatic about, you stopped being a fanatic. We usually kept repeating something until we really know. I guess some people never outgrow that insecurity. It boggles the mind, and sometimes I used to think to myself, I'm really glad that I don't have to see all of this through Jimmy's eyes. At that time, he had about 25 years clean, and I guess he had witnessed all of this, the resurgence, the repetition, and the nonsense for many years. I think the only thing that he used to ask himself was, when are they going to stop arguing and come into the office and do some work? We've always had talkers in NA, but very few who just quietly did the work. At that time in NA history, there was no titles to get, only service to render. And most of it was done on the back porch of a man's home. The preceding three attempts at having the office in a rented place had failed through lack of service, lack of interest, lack of Narcotics Anonymous. The last was above a bail bondsman office in Van Nuys, California. When Jimmy took it back into his home again, there were boxes of orders, opened envelopes, but no checks. Apparently they used the money to pay the rent, but never filled the orders. And no literature, a sad state of affairs, to say the least. This was between 75 and 76. Prior to that, the office was in a man's trunk, not exactly accessible to the fellowship. I don't remember how long it was in that state. Bob B. would know. It was his car. It was not easy for Jimmy to put it back together, but it was easier in 65, 10 years earlier. He sat at the Moore Park meeting with only one other member, Sylvia Wexler, and she asked what he thought they should do. He looked at the little box of literature and said, "We'll go on." This time, at least, there was a good start of a fellowship that extended itself to a few meetings in Phoenix, Arizona. I remember when I first came into NA in 1972. At that time, there were only four meetings in Southern California. I went to a meeting at that time in San Francisco and had to open it up because the secretary wasn't there. It was myself, another clean person, four loaded musicians, and a girl who wasn't sure whether she was an addict or not. This was the state of affairs when Jimmy took over. The addict, with his traditional attitude of, "I got mine," the addicts didn't care if NA ever got out of San Fernando Valley. Of course, at that time, most addicts were going to AA, and if the truth were really told, not a lot really made it. The real break for NA came, and for the addict too, when a man by the name of Bill Beck founded two recovery houses, one in Pasadena called Impact and the other in Sun Valley called Cry Help. Enough addicts came out of these places with a good enough understanding of the program that they stayed clean, and a fellowship was finally to have a group of members that got their sobriety via NA and members of NA. I was in that first group that stayed for 9 months, went back out in society, and had found it unnecessary for 14 years to take any mind-altering chemicals. Jimmy used to drop by once a day and visit, and once a week he conducted a step study. He was a very strong, motivating force for all of us. I was especially impressed with 23 years clean. A couple of years later, I asked him to be my sponsor. His reply was, "I'd rather be your friend." I always valued that friendship. Through the years, we exchanged a lot of things. Some of them, I'm sure, that I have yet to realize. Well, anyway, an office had to be put together and somehow fill the orders that were past due. At that time, all he had was a Social Security check, so he threw that in the pot and the literature was ordered. Eventually, he caught up with it all, and NA was now on its way again. His phone used to ring 24 hours a day, people calling from all over the country. It was safe to say that every existing region of NA had its very first contact with Jimmy K. He was more than just an office worker or contact for NA. He was a friend. The personal touch that he gave people was probably a very strong inspiration for many. He used to tell me, "If that phone would ever just stop ringing, maybe I could get organized and get something done around here." He often did his work in the early morning hours because that's the only time that he could work undisturbed. During this time, he was also in pain. His legs bothered him constantly. He had emphysema, an added heart circulation problem coupled with deteriorating discs in his back, causing him to lose quite a bit of sleep. In that way, the office being in his home was a blessing. When he couldn't sleep, He could always write a letter to some other part of the country and at least give someone else some hope. I noticed something about him that was followed through in my life. It seemed whenever he needed, that was when he gave the most. In giving, he received so much. I remember him telling me sometimes about himself, about a couple of years prior to our meeting, when he had tuberculosis and was in the hospital and was losing his ability to speak. He told his higher power that if he would just give him his voice back, he would for the rest of his life talk about Narcotics Anonymous. He was true to his word. When he was in the hospital, he carved the first NA symbol out of a piece of leather. He said to me that he rarely thought about anything else and getting to a meeting. It was a little later that I finally got into service. It was great going over to Jimmy's house and mailing literature and reading some of the letters that came in from all over the country. For an organization that didn't advertise, NA sure caught on like a house of fire. For a few years, I used to hope to hear from New York because that was the last place I'd used before coming to California. The letters just kept coming, and from them came a reaching out and an effort to addicts that had never been paralleled. One man, with the help of a few addicts, finally had the opportunity to realize his vision and dream. The lesson here, I guess, is to just plug along long enough, and in God's time, all things come into being. I know that he desired nothing else in the world. He was not a man that was ever impressed by the material world. He was a practical man who just believed in planning things out and getting the job done. He used to say to me, if it ain't practical, it ain't spiritual. His feet firmly on the ground, much like facing a bulldog. If you weren't entirely straightforward with the man, he had little use for you. More than once I heard him say to members that were being elusive, when you're ready to come clean, then I'll talk to you. If it wasn't about the work or service or the program, he had little use for the conversation. To my knowledge, he never, as long as I knew him, ever hurt another human being, but I'm sure along the way he did hurt a few feelings. He was a no-nonsense kind of man, and anyone that ever dealt with him personally would tell you that. I think the most difficult time that we had in the WSO was when a person by the name of Boaz came to one of our conferences with a rough draft of what he called the book. Everyone was so enamored at the possibility of N.A. finally getting a book that they were convinced by the way that he spoke that he was indeed the chosen person to do it, and the conference did, in fact, institute a committee giving him full charge and their well wishes. When I first met this man, he claimed to have this mission for N.A. based on the fact that he had been the speed connection for all of Atlanta, Georgia. This was the only way that he could make his amends. He showed me the rough draft that he had. That was a Xerox copy with a big light block through the center of every page, making it impossible to read. I thought at the time that he was either a hustler or a crazy person. Years later, I hold the opinion that he was both. A year later, he came back to the next conference with four file cabinets full of what a girl that was with him told me was the book. Based on her sincerity and my association with her, Shirley C. from Atlanta, I agreed to work with the committee. Being a New York kid, I was not easily convinced, so I asked if they would mind if we, in California, Xeroxed what they had and jointly shared and edited the information. They agreed. That year, I became part of the literature committee. I had the title of literature review chairperson. Bo and Shirley left town after the conference and did not contact me for the rest of the year. We went to a place to Xerox all this great stuff, and I realized and told them that the majority of what they had belonged to other people, articles, medical studies, psychologists' opinions, and papers, and that this was not in any way the making of a book. In fact, I think that out of all of it I reviewed, there were but 20-some-odd pages that were somewhat original and could be a start of a book. Bo was somewhat discouraged and assured me that this psychologist was a friend of his and that he could get his permission to use all the material. I told him that it was not applicable to our book, that he would have to canvass the fellowship for original material, and it was left at that. About then, many things started happening that made my tenure and everyone else's very difficult. I don't know how to explain it or how it started. I think that I probably don't know as much about it as I wish that I did. And maybe in the future, all the facts will be known. I can only write what I know. The year was 1980 and all hell broke loose. It was during my work as chairman of the Southern California RSC that many things started occurring. I had requested $1,000 for the WSO so we could put first and last month's rent on a building that we had located. The decision was made to move the office out of Jimmy's home because there were rumblings that the issue might be brought up the next conference, which was only a few months away. There was talk that they might want to move it to Georgia. We calculated, with so much hullabaloo going on about all the work that they were doing on the book, that they probably could have requested anything and got it. At any rate, I requested the $1,000 from the region. At that time, they had $7,800 in various checking accounts for various committees, which they claimed was prudent reserve, but in spite of all that, the area reps from all areas voted yes. They were very enthusiastic about the idea. Many members at the time were very concerned with the fellowship growing at the rate it was, that we should have something more to show besides Jimmy's back porch. As the chairman, I called the treasurer and requested the check. Simple procedure, yes, complicated process. She said she would meet me the next evening in a dance with the check. She didn't show up. I called her and she agreed to meet me again. I felt that I was being stalled. She met me, refused to write a check, and said that I should call the chairman of the Board of Trustees. He told me that I should wait until the next conference to move the office and that I had no right soliciting the money from my committee. I took this back to the regional committee and I debated the issue until we won. The treasurer resigned. I fired off a letter to the Board of Trustees demanding to know why they were trying to control my committee. Much transpired, and the details are too numerous to list here. The crux of it went something like this. Calls were made to every region from the Board of Trustees outside of Southern California, asking them to freeze any money that they intended to send the WSO until after the conference. Literature orders dropped drastically, and we were informed that somewhere pamphlets were being produced without our knowledge and distributed all over the mid to southern southeastern regions. I can only posit a theory that is that some of the money earmarked for the literature committee ended up in this undertaking. Well, the office was moved and we received enough orders to keep on going. I have to add at this time that a lot of areas ordered large orders and never paid for them. We seemed to be under fire and just couldn't figure out where it was coming from. A task that started out of love and service was ending up in a war. It became apparent after a short period of time what was going on. Again, the events are so complex and too numerous to list here. The meetings of the 80-81 conference bear most of it out on the surface. The rest doesn't leave much to the imagination. Out of the last literature conferences that were held in Southern California came the joining together of two groups of people. One, the new NA, or greater NA, as they would later blatantly refer to themselves, and another group of people were the friends and sponsees of a few people who still had an axe to grind with Jimmy over issues that were now almost two decades old. These same people who had been involved in the original NA rift between Northern and Southern California were now reemerging in the form of people that they sponsored. They rarely came out front, but were always close by. I was to realize that in my short time around, I too would be considered their enemy. Wasn't it I who had made them take the AA books out of their meetings? I guess when I threw in with Jimmy Kay, there was a lot that I was to understand for me personally. I was also along with his friendship, to inherit his enemies. He never made any bones about it. He told me everything. I went in with my eyes open and just took this warning about certain people as truth and did the best I could. I never realized how much power that hate and resentment have until this juncture in my life. at this point in time, the literature committee, which had not really ever been very communicative with the office anywhere, showed up at the next conference with a printed and copyrighted copy of what they called our book and requested that we print it immediately. I remember the chairman for the Board of Trustees went over to Jimmy's house and told him that he thought it was a beautiful piece of work and that we should publish it as is immediately. Needless to say, what they had was not the book and was to undergo many changes over a period of 3 years until it became somewhat readable, free of plagiarisms and redundancies, and at least qualifiable to be called our basic text. I can only surmise from the events that happened that somewhere a plan was devised to publish the book, move the conference, move the office, and remove Jimmy from the new NA, or greater NA, as they referred to themselves. At that time, all indications pointed toward a split in the fellowship. If this group of individuals, now united within and outside of the state, didn't get their way, Jimmy went to the lawyers and closed the corporation to keep it from being penetrated by these factions who were becoming more vocal and starting to surface everywhere, especially at the conference. I want to give a very special recognition to Bob B. of the Board of Trustees. One can duly note in the minutes, along with Bill B., who constantly reminded these individuals on the conference floor that the WSO was an outside issue and a separate entity that had the same autonomy and right as any other committee represented there. It would take the faction another 2 years to figure out how to get around that. For the meantime, we were able to hold the line and secure the home front so that Narcotics Anonymous wouldn't be taken over by a group of addicts who were proving to us that they were fast becoming self-serving and treated the traditions like they were there for them and only them to interpret. If you voiced a different opinion, you were accused of disunity, stirring the pot, if you will. It was not long before that the discrediting of the WSO began to occur. There were slurs about people not getting the literature ordered, letters not answered, and talk and accusations about the members in the office using the phones to propagandize, whatever that meant. I wondered what kind of organization I was a part of, and for that matter, what country I was living in. It was very clear that this coalition, which included many of the Board of Trustees, there's still a few around today, would do anything within its power to further its ends. The slurs were endless. I still hear them today. A girl from Florida recently asked me if I'd burned all the records in the WSO. The rumors persist that I am just a guy from California who used to work in office and has a resentment because he was thrown out. The tactics that these people used are abhorrent, and as Jimmy used to say, reprehensible. In May of 81, he gave me his personal resignation to deliver to the conference and read. It was one of the saddest days of my life. I felt that if he was leaving the Board of Trustees, who could you trust? I have, in the course of service in NA, had many points of disillusionment. This was one of the greatest. Quote, due to the unconscionable actions of some members of the Board of Trustees on a personal level, and the mistrust, division, and disunity engendered by the same within the fellowship, I submit my resignation on this date, April 27, 1981. His resignation was then followed by Bill B. His statement in short reads, I hereby resign as a member of the Board of Trustees because I refuse to do business with deceit and dishonesty. That more or less summed it up. The chairman of the board stated that he would gladly accept Bill's resignation on whatever conditions he placed it. He was to later on lull the conference to sleep by stating after renominating Jimmy back to the board that he was sure Jimmy would come back to his senses and come back to the board. He further stated to quell any further thoughts about the board that Jimmy was to N.A. as Bill W. was to A.A. and that no one on that board had gone out of their way to hurt him. All they wanted to do was steal his dream and take it to Atlanta. As Bo was once overheard saying by the secretary of the conference and myself, We didn't want to hear about those people driving Cadillacs out in California after this book is published. He further stated, which I think is very solicitous of him, that Jimmy is of his right mind and in good health, that he just met with him that very morning and he was all right. The rumor was, along with other slurs, started that he was senile and he couldn't listen to reason. All that I can tell you about this part of service or the business of NA was that almost daily a devastating experience. As each day opened, there were more rumors, more innuendos. Jimmy took the position that we would answer none of it. Just keep our heads down and do the work. I don't think to this day that many people really know the whole truth. That is, besides the individuals who spread the lies to begin with. The lies that were spread hurt not only Jimmy and the people in the office, but the addicts themselves, NA as a whole. I was the main speaker at the 12th World Convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. After I got off the podium, a young girl fell at my feet crying, "Please let them print the book. Why don't you let them print the book?" She told me that her brother had OD'd a few weeks before, and that if she had had the book, she could have saved his life. I felt so sorry for her, and in trying to comfort her, I forgot to ask her where she got that information. It was very bizarre. A throng of people were standing in line to thank me, and an accuser hangs on my legs, crying like I was Napoleon, responsible for the life and death of a civilization. A similar experience happened to Jimmy Kay in New York after he appeared at the 13th World Convention. An accuser stopped him and asked him what the fuck he did with the money from the book, referring to the money raised by the fellowship for the book that was lost in a bankruptcy by the printing firm that we contracted to print it. It was not long before that these individuals, some board of trustees and others, put together an ad hoc committee through the conference in 1982 to, as they put it, get to the bottom of things. If a frontal assault didn't work, I guess they would go through the bottom. They gathered up a report of complaints at the time that they felt would be satisfactory to dismiss our board, all in the name of unity. And Sally E. was at the forefront of that movement. In the course of that conference, a select committee was appointed to deal with this issue behind closed doors. This was a last-minute decision which they came about through my informing them that I, too, had a report. Mine dealt with the breaking of traditions by the Board of Trustees, not just a few letters not getting mailed. Without going into the infinite of what went down in this committee, of who said what to whom, I will take special note that James D., newly elected board member, upon leaving, after I was in the process of reading my report, exclaiming, "I want to get out of here. I think that I'm going to throw up." I'm sure that the recounting of this story, he'll probably say that he had the flu that day. If you know anyone long enough, probably everyone changes their story. At any rate, the rest is history. As far as my leaving the office, it was precipitated by the standing board and the newly elected board to the WSO. I came to work in the office one day, and one of the volunteers came up to me and told me that there had been some changes. The WSO board had met and elected a new president. This being news to me, I further inquired. It seems that the board had an emergency meeting called by the president, Phil P., and that he had resigned last night and had nominated a new president who was elected. The new president was Chuck G. This, to me, was the most vicious cut of all. I was the vice president of a nonprofit organization, duly elected to that board with a legal responsibility, and was not even called to an emergency meeting or present at the elections of a new president. To say that I felt slighted is to understate it. I felt humiliated, deceived, and betrayed. I called the lawyer for the corporation and asked him what recourse I had. This was an obvious error, like calling your wife's lawyer during a divorce. He told me that he didn't see any recourse that I had and said frankly to me that he had never encountered a situation like this before and agreed with me that it was a very unusual thing to happen for a nonprofit organization. He couldn't figure what the gain was in the move. I was all too familiar with the move. I had seen it used before. In the case of Bill B., it had cost him the two recovery houses that he had founded. In both cases, discrediting information was first circulated, then the balance. I think that this is called character assassination. A sad commentary on a great career that a man embarked upon, only to be cheated out of it when he reached the goal. Not unlike what happened to Jimmy. There are many in this fellowship who should be searching their conscience about what they said and did to these men. Many of the individuals involved were the same people in both cases. I'm not asking anyone to do that for me, because what was done to me didn't destroy my life, livelihood, or dreams. It only hurt my feelings. It made me grow up a little faster than I would have chosen to and prompted me to write these things. The thing I've been taught and learned it well is to write. Jimmy had signed off the corporation a year prior to all the eventual power struggles. I guess he saw the writing on the wall. At the time of my resignation, Jimmy was working as the office manager, having demoted himself from director and president of the corporation to office manager, and was happy to just make sure the day-to-day work went smoothly. By the next conference, with no one there really to protest, they voted him out and elected a new office manager. I often wondered what the threat was with him just being there, overseeing the work and sharing the legacy of his program with the newer members. He was a man that could accept change. He'd have been happy to do it. After all, wasn't the new office manager called the executive director? Wouldn't there have been enough room in this organization to let him just stay or come in a few days a week? What I guess I'm really asking is, don't these people have any respect? Was the hunger for power so great that all power, even personal power, of a single man had to go? Was the vendetta so deep that all who got in its way had to be vanquished? Wasn't there just a little room still left in anyone's heart for the founder of Narcotics Anonymous? Yes, founder, conceiver, worker among workers, first committed and last to leave. Until recently, I always had those questions in my mind. Recently, I had them all answered for me. First, they changed one word back to the way AA says it, which was my first indication that the old guard was back. These instead of those. Those indicate in the 11 steps that precede the 12th step, which is a result of those 11 steps, we had a spiritual awakening, which makes perfect sense to me. It also made perfect sense to the man who was inspired to make that change in 1953, along with adding we before each step and changing alcohol to addiction. A few simple changes that significantly changed the lives of thousands of people, now a worldwide endeavor. But now, 35 years later, we are told that the steps the way they used to be aren't good enough. I only wonder if these individuals get away with this, what they will do next. They send around the changes to meetings along with a message to stop using certain words, that it's bad for newcomers, and 20 newcomers disappear out of our Hollywood meetings, and the beat goes on. Where is it going to end? When I want to start petitions to stop this power madness by certain members of the fellowship who aren't happy that they have all the positions of power in the organization, they get free plane trips all over the world, free hotel and meals. Ambassadors to the unknown is what they should be calling themselves. Apparently, all the public adulation, all the freebies just aren't enough. They now want to revise the literature and change the steps. Tell everyone how to talk and just generally run all our lives and spiritual programs and control what we read. Protect us from any words that might have something to do with sanity. What is all this bullshit about? Now, I know why they wanted Jimmy to disappear. he was the only sane person left that had to reckon with. He was the only one who would have told them that they were crazy. I mean, all right, if we're all crazy because no one will know the difference. Now, if we can just convince everyone else that we're sane and they're crazy, we will be all right. This is a group of lunatics. To change any part of this program or the steps is like going to Ford Motor Company and telling them to redesign their engine because it doesn't work. To get back to reality, pardon my trip. When all this stuff came down at the last conference, I was about as confused and unknowledgeable as anyone else. It has taken me several weeks to just comprehend the information that I have and to reconstruct, with help of conference participants, what went on at that great gathering where that group of addicts got together to one more time save all of our lives. It seems that according to a member from England, I couldn't find anyone far enough away from the problem or without the usual religious fanatical fervor to talk about it. They offered us the changes to vote on. We voted against them. So they tried to find a more palatable way of coming at us with them so that they could get the desired yes vote. When they didn't get the desired yes, they went into an ad hoc committee to discuss them. After 5 days, they finally got their way, and we went home. If you remove the 12 votes that the Board of Trustees hold, they seem to be voting en masse according to the minutes of the conference, you would not have been able to get those changes through. I don't blame them for voting for change. After all, they did change the literature that they were asking everyone to cooperate with them and vote on. They made those changes regardless of historical content or continuity or spirit of the literature that they violated. I feel like someone had torn up a Bible in front of me, and I have to grin and bear it and work my perfect program. Well, folks, guess what? I'm not like a lot of you. I don't have to look good all the time. As far as what you say about me, I don't really care. When you discredit 10 years of service and hard work in this organization by just summarizing my whole service career with, quote, "He's just a guy that we kicked out of the office and now he has a resentment," it really doesn't matter. I saw how you treated my best friend and what you said about him, and I would consider it an honor if you treat me the same way. I will promise you one thing, though. No matter what you say in your rebuttal, no matter how dishonest you become, I will not lie about you the way you lied about me. I would not betray and desert you the way you did to me. I would not alienate you from your fellows and reject you as a human being because of what you think. I will not judge you in private and say other when I see your face. You can say whatever you want to at any meeting that I attend, and I won't pull you aside afterward and defile and violate your being by telling you the words that I don't want to hear you say. Because I live in America and I'm a member of Narcotics Anonymous and was told by an old man that I could be anything that I had to be until I discovered who I really was. I learned recovery the right way, the free way, where conditions were non-existent. What I was offered when I got here was love, and along with it a responsibility which was offered to me unconditionally and would always be available to those who came after me. I know that I could turn and walk away. God knows what my involvement in the past has cost me, but maybe today it just might be a little different. After all, aren't I still an addict? Maybe this time it will be different, and people will care when I tell them what I know and how I feel. Maybe a few addicts like myself will take courage and move ahead to our proper places as concerned member of Narcotics Anonymous, who can't accept that there is no such thing as a recovered addict, that there are no musts in NA, doesn't exist anymore, that we have no leaders, has been eliminated, that this program is no longer a suggested program. That's it. That's from Doug F.
this time, we'd like to ask Fawn if she'd like to say anything about where she left things off last night, or in reference to anything she didn't finish saying, or about this letter.
And did anybody have any questions that, I don't know, I pretty much, what I covered last night, I finished, and I think someone approached me this morning and asked me about what progress is being made in the way of putting some kind of a text, a history text together. And I've spoken to Betty quite frequently. Betty was Jimmy's wife, and she's got lots and lots of file cabinets of archival history of Narcotics Anonymous, because Jimmy was a saver of a lot of stuff, written correspondence to and from individuals confirming that we were not a part of any, that we had no affiliation with the early NA in New York or Louisville, Kentucky, Lexington, I'm sorry. And, well, anyway, so God knows what's there. And it's been very hard for her to open up. She's moved a couple of times, and she schleps all these file cabinets wherever she goes, and she's kept them closed for a long time because it was painful for her to, you know, go through all that stuff. A few years ago, Lynn A., a friend of ours, approached Bob Stone at the office and said that that Betty was willing to turn all of these historical archives over to Narcotics Anonymous under one condition, that they not be revised, edited, or changed in any way, because they represented how NA, as we know it, began. And there was no, there was an immediate answer by Bob, and he said, no, I can't give you that condition, because as soon as you give us something, the office can do with it whatever we want to do with it. So under those conditions, she said, forget it. And so now they're, needless to say, because of the events that happened, she's not very trusting to a lot of people who are over anxious to get something going because, you know, of what you just heard and stuff like that. She was very apprehensive about who to trust with this project because she knows she can't do it alone. So a few of us have been working on that, and we're scheduled to meet with her either this summer or in the fall, and we're going to start trying to put this stuff into some kind of order by months, maybe by years first, by months, so that NA can have some kind of a historical something to go with. As far as the final outcome of the project, how it will ever get, if it will ever be approved as we know literature, how it gets approved today through the conference, I don't know if it would ever happen that way. And a lot of that should be understandable after the letter you just heard read here, because a lot of our history affects those people who are still empowered. So that's where the difficult part's going to come in, because, you know, that's it. But from what I understand, this is all, she has all this historical stuff, and something's being, she's ready. So I know that there's some history workshops going on. I know there's one in Alabama in August. They're real excited about it. They're handing flyers out. I don't know if you guys up here have received those flyers. If you haven't, I guess I can send some to Dave or to Billy and you guys can pass them out. So there's workshops starting to happen, and right now I think what's going on is people are talking about the history, because maybe that's the beginning of anything. Just like with our basic text, there was, as Bo will cover later, there was talking of the idea first has to be discussed and talked about, and then it starts to become something. Okay. Oh, great.
Well, I'm grateful that we had to have a couple of questions. Hey, family. It's like part of the problem today, as Douglas said in his letter, is that currently people who are in positions of power are still running our world services and flying around. Our world service board of director chairperson and the chairperson of our world service board of trustees were some of the people that Douglas was referring to in that letter that stole Cry Help and Impact from Bill Beck. Isn't that correct?
That's one question.
You want to know if that was correct? Well, put it this way. Bill Beck was the executive director, and Jack was the assistant executive director. And these treatment centers were run by dope fiends for dope fiends, and it was it wasn't very structured. They lived off donations from the community. They'd send van loads of residents out and to Safeway, can you give us some bread to feed us? And it was like a 6 to 9 month program, and I don't know all the details because I was a resident at that time in Cry Help and when Bill Beck was the executive director. And that's where I first heard it, you know. I mean, I loved being there. I learned a lot about myself and the program when I was there. I don't know what went down. I wasn't behind the board meetings. All I know is that Bill Beck, he took a typewriter home, and a lot of times, I know another issue that I think the board had of the treatment center was that a lot of times we would do trading, like a printing company would give us paper if we sent a couple of the residents over there to collate, you know. So it was like, I think they charged him for, accused him of slave labor or something. But no, I don't recall when I was being a resident there ever feeling like I was being used or misabused or whatever.
To get him. I just want people to know that we're being led by thieves and liars and punks.
I have in that letter it talks about a north-south rift.
Yeah.
But it refers to a north-south rift.
Yeah.
Just like today we seem to have like an east West riff.
Right.
Narcotics Anonymous. Repetitive historical past that seems to be in that same direction today again. And, that north-south rift, could you put more light onto that?
Well, I know that it had to do with, like the letter was talking about, it had a lot to do with the AA terminology and literature being used at our NA meetings. You know, back then you have to understand that most addicts were going to AA and NA. NA wasn't always as large, so a lot of people were going to both. A lot of the trustees that are on the board today, you know, they started out in AA, and that's where NA was at back then. So when There was a lot of resentment that was born when this movement started to happen about let's NA stand up on its own two feet and be a fellowship onto its own and quit using AA's literature and stop all these tradition violations. And that didn't sit too well with some of the old timers. There's always been that competitive thing. You know, it's who can do it better, who's got it stronger, who's got more, you know.
I'm an addict, Yeshua by name.
Hi, Yeshua.
See if I can word this right. I'm trying to think of how to say this and put it on a respectable level instead of a street level. Okay. We got these people, this board of directors, who have their foundation in AA, that's what I'm understanding, and they can't seem to detach from that and be NA people to help Narcotics Anonymous. I guess my question is, it doesn't help me for somebody to tell me the board or the directors. I need James this, Andrew that, Andre this, Sandra this, whoever the names are, what their position is, and how we can write letters to them and tell them what we don't like what they're doing or whatever, and how we as the fellowship can organize to remove them and put people who are responsible in those positions to continue the primary purpose of Narcotics Anonymous. I mean,
well, all the information is available to everybody.
How?
It's in your World Service Conference meeting minutes. If you just take a little bit of time and do your homework,
okay,
you can see the names,
okay,
yourself. Who made the motions?
It's, okay.
Read who's making the motions.
Okay.
That's very important. The history of the conferences is another very important thing to understand. Early on in our history, everybody could vote.
Okay,
it's pretty much the way you have it now. The board, the different boards all had a vote. Okay, now another thing that was also possible back then was that these World Service subcommittees, if you wanted to be a member, if any NA member wanted to be a member, they could. They weren't closed subcommittees. Anybody who was anybody in NA, all you had to do was say, hey, I want to be a part of it. So you'd try your best to fly yourself out to when they met and all that, right? Okay. Another thing that was happening at the conference was that as long as you were a member of a subcommittee, you could talk. You couldn't vote, but you could speak. So this is how a lot of shit got stirred up at the conferences. You had a lot of people talking and a lot of movements going on at the same time. I mean, this is how I saw it, okay? So there was a lot of confusion. But if you go through your meeting minutes, when the meetings were written back then, because I was secretary for two conferences in a row, and I did names,
okay,
you know, I don't believe in this other shit. I didn't always reveal a last name, but at least I put the first name and the initial. Who made the motion? Some of the discussion, was it carried or was it failed? A lot of times and you can sort of get a feeling for who, you can see the movements being formed, and what you can really see when you look through all this is how the shaping personalities have shaped our world services. That's what's happened. And my personal opinion is that because all these boards who have a vote and a voice at the conference, they represent nobody but themselves. How could they possibly feel and experience what a group conscience is, a vote is, right? I mean, not the way an RSR could. So my feeling has always been if the RSRs are the only ones who can vote because they represent someone, they don't even represent themselves, technically. They represent their regions. If they would come to the world, and that's all that's on the agenda, is what your region wants. there's no room for any of this other ego shit that's going on, you know, because these too much is coming from the world down to my region, and I know it's not coming from my region and going to the world, so that's sort of, and I think how that was born was years ago in NA, because of the, I guess it's the overall mentality or personality of the addict. If somebody else will do it for me, let them, right? The apathetic stuff. You know, with GSRs, ASRs, and RSRs, it was always like, okay, you're our GSR, you're our ASR, or you're our RSR. Go vote how you feel best for us, you know. We'll give you that vote of confidence, you know. So that's where your problems happen, see? And if you think about it, most of your people who are involved with service work are new in recovery. I don't know that all of them have worked all the steps or familiarized themselves. That's a very dangerous thing to put upon anyone. You know, I'm going to vote how I see fit and hope that it's God's will. So what you see happening is, I think it's very natural when you're overwhelmed and new in a big group of people. You want to be heard. You want to let people know, hey, I'm on the ball. I know what's happening. So this is what happens, you know, because they can just arbitrarily make a motion or when it's come from nowhere. So that's what I see as being the disease in our world services is that it's stopped being a group conscience endeavor. You know, I mean, regional reps may go there and vote certain ways, but they're being manipulated and politicked when they get there, you know, because these issues aren't talked about at home. I mean, because I read these minutes. I never heard these issues in my area. My group never made a motion to do a lot of this stuff with the changing of our literature. So I think if we got back to the basics, open committees, a system of rotation, more volunteerism, and true group conscience, that we will heal our world services. And it starts with the group. It starts with, you know, how well is your group, how well are your business meetings going? You know, encourage the members to participate in the group conscience. You know, teach them the difference between a group conscience and a vote, you know. And expect more from our GSR and our ASRs and our RSRs. And this stuff won't happen, you know, because we've laid it all, you know. We know what the group conscience is, you know.
Okay. I understand that Betty has this compilation of material, and she wants to put it in the proper place and proper hands. Is there a group of concerned NA members like yourself who understand the sophistication of all of this, and you're acquiring a place to put all this stuff, and somebody to go through this to put our history in a chronological, reasonable, rational, readable order so that us as NA members can read this and get it, I mean, you're going to get it printed? Or, in other words, what's being done starting with today about getting this material together?
Well, there were a lot of people around the world. There's a young lady by the name of Lynn up in New York, upstate New York. There's some people in California I know Lynn is a writer, a professional writer, and I'm a professional typist. You know, so I don't know. I don't know what the final outcome is going to be, but I know that what's going to be started this year is that we're going to all meet and we're going to at least put it in some form and try to get the ball rolling. Does that answer your question? Hi.
Hi, I'm Adam and Jody.
Hi, Jody.
Before I get to the question, I need to share something briefly. First, I wish to make a statement that I never used the chemical alcohol, and I never went through any treatment center, rehab, nothing. I'm a pure NA baby and very proud of it. Recovery from the disease, not only being clean, it's possible in NA only. And I have a right to this fellowship of NA, pure, unadulterated NA. I have a right to that. It's why I had to leave California. I couldn't find NA. And there's two people in this room that have taught me something very much. One person taught me a lot about the principles and the steps and the traditions and the politics and the importance that personal recovery depends on this. We can't run from this. Our personal recovery depends on NA unity. And I see people, you know, throwing up their hands, not wanting to be involved, but personal recovery depends on it. And someone else has taught me that sometimes our disease can get so lost in the intellectualism behind this and get so caught up in focusing on the politics that we lose the personal side of this. Mm-hmm. That how is it affecting us? How is it affecting the newcomers? I see people throughout not wanting to get involved in the controversy and not understanding how this relates to them. Well, what does history have to do with me? What does history have to do with recovery? What does history... I was talking to someone this morning that really pointed up that I like this address, because I heard a newcomer say, and I've had the same experience, that they tried reading the fifth edition and they were not getting it. It was like a textbook to them. They were not understanding it. And as soon as they got a copy of this unapproved Rebellious Outlaw third edition revised, it clicked. And this is what we're talking about here. This does affect our recovery. It affects the recovery of the members. It affected my recovery. I'm living out there being fed lies and dying from my disease and not knowing what's wrong until I got the truth. It does affect personal recovery. And in that area where the denial is so thick, there are addicts with 8 and 10 years clean killing themselves and not knowing why, because of this propaganda. And now that I know that they're not hearing the NA message and hearing this propaganda is a lot of why these people have been killing themselves clean. And an avoidance of the personal side of this. You know, like the two extremes. You know, the head in the sand versus the head in the clouds. And my question is, I would like to know from Doug, I would like to know from Bo and from Greg and from you and all these people, I would like to know your opinion on how this affects each member, their recovery, and how it's affected your personal life. Because, you know, I found out I was pregnant yesterday. And my immediate response was, you know, I had a material comfort in California. And I'm not having that here, but I have found NA and I have found recovery. And my immediate response was, I'm going to go back to California, do the financially responsible thing. And I'm also here on a mission, not only for my personal recovery, but on a mission, so to speak. And what I've heard here from each one of you, has made me realize that money doesn't solve everything, that we can be dead and rich from this disease. And it has affected, this weekend has affected my personal life because I've decided to stay here. Someone said to me last night, my disease would love me to go to California. It's true. So, you know, let's address how this is affecting the individual member and us. That's kind of my question. Let's not get so caught up in all these politics that we don't see that, because it does. You know, there's addicts out there dying because they're not hearing the NA message. I know. I was almost one of them.
Thanks for sharing. How has all this affected me? It's made me angry. It's made me sad. It's made me feel powerless and ineffective. Like my hands are tied. There's nothing I can do, so why do anything? That's pretty much the feeling. You know, I remember when I had about 4 years clean and I quit. I was living out here and I called my girlfriend on the West Coast and I said, I can't believe what happened. I can't believe what happened. Why did it happen? How can that, it can't be God's will. It just can't. And she said, just remember, every dog has its day. So I had to like, okay, that sounds good, you know. So I guess, I don't know. I'd like to see change come about done in a peaceful way. I don't really get off on fighting the way I used to. When I was younger in my recovery, I was had a lot of anger, so I could like get in there and roll my sleeves up and, you know, really get off on all that. But it disturbs the little peace that I have in my life today to hear what I hear and still feel those old familiar feelings again. It inspires me to see members that have come after me who make a commitment not only to Narcotics Anonymous but to try and make NA better for the newcomer. And I know the people who make that commitment, it's kind of hard to walk around peacefully and talk about these issues because, you know, when you love NA, when people are messing with it or distorting it as how you know it is to be, it makes you angry. You know, it's our life. Every now and then, you know, every meeting I go to, I go by the literature displayed at the tables. And one time my friend Leah said, Fawn, why do you always, you know, go to the tables to look at the literature? And I said, I just want to make sure they haven't changed our name yet. So, anyway, that's how it has affected me. I'm resolved in a lot of the things, but there's still some old pain that I'm still not quite come to terms with. I'm still confused about the way some things happened. And I don't really see anything. I don't know. I don't know, because when I share with the newcomers, I don't share about these issues. I just share about the program, you know, and they can't take that away from me, you know. So I don't know. Maybe if our literature's changed enough, maybe I could see how it would affect the newcomer. You know, if you change a lot of times taking out one word or inserting a new word can change a whole meaning and a spirit of a paragraph. So, but.
This is going to be a real simple one for you, but. Because I'm just going to ask for a yes or no when I'm done with it. I'm going to ask you if maybe I'm correct to assume something. Because I'm going to assume something right now. Okay? Because Jody was just asking the question there, and you basically talked about, you know, how it affected you. But the basic effects of history, if we had our history documented, put down all the issues that we've gone through, from 1953, the growing process, the conference actual growth from when it started, the office when it started, and the decision-making process, how it evolved, and where it's taken us to today, that if we had all that documented, I would be almost like to assume that we'd have something to take a look at and be able to better clarify and make decisions in a home group on the direction we're going as a fellowship. But also it would protect us basically from ourselves, from making bad decisions, from allowing the power structure to be created then. If we could have that document and we could see that, how it grew and how this here, what we look at it saying it's a power structure. The letter talked about old guard. The old guard, as I know the care, is more of an AA philosophy, which is introducing an AA service structure to us basically right now. Which I mean, it was just in a fellowship report on going to Colombia, and really the World Service Office today endorsing them following the AA service structure, you know, and helping set that up overseas, you know, the same thing with the principles that they're talking about with our concepts, whatever they want to call it today. But it's basically,
you know, this stuff we could see a lot better if we had our history documented. Would I be correct to assume that?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if having all our history in black and white is, I can't answer that. I mean, how do I know?
Would you be able to see it if it was written? And say, hold it? And say, this has happened in the past, and it didn't work. It's documented here. It's factual. And why are we going this direction again?
Sounds good.
Yeah, it
did. And I'll tell you something else that worked that was very effective. If you're really upset with the way things are going on at the world, en masse movements are very effective. If just, I don't care. I mean, one year at the conference, there were people from all over Georgia who flew in, hitchhiked, showed up bare feet, barefooted. I mean, they were there, newcomers, some with like 30 days, you know. They were committed to this effort. It was very impressive. So, you know, we as a group, if we band together and impress upon the conference what our concerns are and demand that we get the answers that we're looking for, I haven't lost hope in that process. I believe it can and should work. I'm just as baffled by all of this as most of you are. I don't go to those conferences anymore. Until every one of them has resigned and I can be assured that none of their sponsees have taken their places, I refuse to go. I have no interest. I think it should be on a rotation system. We need the freshness and the newness and giving everybody a chance. I don't know. That would be my suggestion.
I'm grateful, Dave. I'm that.
Hi, Dave.
I'm going to keep hitting this mic. And, you know, I'm going to ask questions, but I'm going to have to make them more like in a statement because I'm not getting direct answers, you know. And that the purpose of our history, at least in my viewpoint, is for all of the people to sit down and say what they got to say and pull no punches and name names and everybody gets to say their thing and it's printed up and that's the history. And that's the discussion. Everybody's perspective, right, wrong, or indifferent. Now, I know a lot of stuff. I know a lot of stuff. I could stand up here all day with stuff that has been perpetrated on this fellowship in the name of the still-suffering addict. The vile undertones and the manipulation and the lies. You know, Jimmy Kinnon walking to the door of the World Service Office and having a box kicked out. Thanks for 32 years of answering the phones. You know, I know about what I said about, because the man that wrote that letter told me what happened. And I know Stu Tardman and I know Jack Bernstein. I've been knowing them for years. They've been lying to us for years. They lied to you just recently on the telephone. So, let's get real. Bob Stone was there and Bob Raymar was there. They just appeared. They just showed up one day at the World Service Office and nobody knew who they were or where they came from. And there was letters sent from the World Service Office all to the East Coast and personal phone calls made by these people to make Jimmy look like a schmuck and get him kicked out. And there was lies told, and those people are still controlling the fellowship. The Chuck Skinners, the Chuck Gates, the Raymars, the new generation, the Hallahans, and these people are perpetrating a hoax on us in the name of the addict that still suffers. So we got to have this truth told. And I come up to the microphone and people say, oh, goddamn, Dave, you're angry. Well, you're fucking right I'm angry, because I've been involved with these people for 6 years plus. And I know them, and he knows them, and we know them. And you guys don't know them. So you can't believe that this shit goes on in Narcotics Anonymous, because you go to NA as such, which is the home group, where everything is warm and fuzzy and everybody loves one another and it's all fucking spiritual. Well, let me tell you something. That ain't reality. That is not reality. And there are millions and millions of dollars being played with that belongs to God. It doesn't belong to a corporation. It doesn't belong to anybody. This message, our book, belongs to God. Give it to him for 50 cents. Give it to him. All right? Who needs a World Service office to get bigger and bigger and bigger? They ain't doing nothing but perpetrating a great big hoax on this fellowship in the name of the addict who still suffers. There are 70, 80, 100 people that go to a World Service conference and don't do anything that we do in our home groups. And all it takes is one trip. Open your eyes. Open your mouths. Tell the truth. Bo knows stuff. You know stuff. I know stuff. Forrest knows stuff. Billy knows stuff. We know shit that would make you sick and make you crawl out the door. But we're still here clean, carrying a message. And the truth is something that we desperately, desperately need. Now, I'm going to back off, but I'm not going to come back again. And I'm going to make these question, quote, statements, slash. But we need direct answers. You know, Sally Evans' friend, Jacqueline Lair, gets hired before the World Service Conference for $100,000. To write It Works How and Why, and the literature committee comes up with a new idea. Oh boy, we didn't approve anything professionally written before, but now we've got this great new idea. Let's hire professional writers, only let's pay them. They're addicts, so we can control them. That's what you're going to be reading from now on. That's what that fourth and fifth edition is. There were never conference approved. It was dope fiended on the floor. When are we going to wake up? That literature, a pamphlet. Get a pamphlet. Go to a printer. A quarter of a cent. A quarter of a cent. Go to a copy machine. You can have pamphlets in your home group for a penny.
Dave, yeah. I'm telling you, the answer is, you will take the power away from these people who represent no one if you insist that regional reps vote their group conscience. There is nothing else to discuss. There's no underhanded, under-the-table motions. There's no getting wined and dined with dinners, promises being made that you'll get this or that.